I don't think anybody who's been lecturing as long as I really needs a microphone, but nonetheless, I'm going to turn it on. So let me know if you have any trouble hearing me. And thank you for that very gracious introduction. You failed to say that for some of the people here, I'm also known as Steve Kivelson's mother. He is, for those of you who don't know Steve, he's a condensed matter theorist. My husband was a physical chemist of note, so we have lots of connections with the different sciences represented here today, and I'm very happy to be here. So I'm going to talk about electromagnetic periodicities at Saturn. And the reason that electromagnetic periodicities are interesting will very soon become apparent. The work has been pursued in collaboration with my longtime collaborator David Southwood and a graduate student at UCLA, Shanja Jha, who's responsible for some of the diagrams I will provide. So what am I going to talk about? Well, the issue is really, what is Saturn's spin period? How do you identify it? And what are the problems with our abilities to identify it? I'll talk about the fact that the periods that we have identified and thought of as Saturn's spin period drift. They are not stable. Lots of people have tried to explain why there are drifting periods, and so I will talk briefly about other people's models and do some diagnosis of what's wrong with them. And then I'll talk about our model and provide incontrovertible evidence supported by typical best-case illustrations of why our model is right. But in the end, I will have to acknowledge that we don't know what we're doing, but it's a fascinating problem. So spin rate is of great importance to studies of planetary structure and evolution. For terrestrial planets with solid surfaces, there's no problem in figuring out what the spin period is. We establish it directly. The gas giants are more challenging. They lack solid surfaces. So one thing we can do is to track the clouds as the bodies spin and observe the rate. And in fact, if any of you have ever looked at the various systems describing the period of Jupiter, you'll find there's system 1, system 2, system 3. As I remember, system 1 just looked at some general cloud, system 2 looked at the red spot, and system 3 finally came up with ways of doing it based on electromagnetic measurements. So I will talk a bit about that. And those have to do, the way you do that is by looking at signs of rotation of the internal magnetic field, which for Jupiter, Uranus, and Saturn is very asymmetric about the spin axis. So you can, as the planet spins, you can watch changes in the magnetic field and properties associated with that. You can watch it, those things change and get the magnetic, get a rotation rate that turns out to be very stable. Radio emissions from these bodies are modulated at the same period. And so what you have is a dipole magnetic field, maybe radio emissions coming from some place, magnetic equator tilted, but then as the planet rotates, that tilted equator goes up and down. So measurements modulated by the changing orientation of the magnetic dipole are used for Jupiter, Neptune, and Uranus to establish the rotation period. But the problem with Saturn's magnetic field from this point of view is that two of the best estimates from analysis of data taken in the vicinity of Saturn, the internal magnetic field is axially symmetric. So as the planet rotates, there's no magnetic signature to help us. One thing, though, that is found to, I go back to Saturn now, and we could use cloud motion, just the way I tried to show you had been done at Jupiter, but the different cloud layers move at different rates, and it's not clear which cloud layer to follow. You can figure out that the period is something like 10.7 hours. When Voyager had its flybys of Saturn, they found that there was very strong radiated power in the kilometric range. So we refer to that as SKR, Saturn Kilometric Radiation. And that at near the cloud rotation period, the intensity of the radiation in this particular wavelength band was modulated at roughly 10.7 hours. So everybody said, aha, there must be a higher order magnetic moment that is not axially symmetric, and we are seeing it indirectly through the modulation of this radio frequency emission. And those radio frequency emissions have been followed by subsequent spacecraft, Voyager first, and then Ulysses, and more recently Cassini. And the initial data came up with a period which I will give you more accurately, but about 10.7 hours. It was assumed to be the rotation period of the planetary interior and was adopted as the official rotation period by IAU, the International Astronomical Union. So if you look up the rotation period of Saturn, that's what you'll find. And here is the kind of data that was used to show that. This is radio emission in the kilometric radiation band. And as you can see, it's modulated, and the arrows guide the eye to show you that if you analyze over a long enough time, you find that the radio, that there's a repeatable period. And the official period then was given as 10 hours, 39 minutes, 24 plus or minus, and I think that was meant to be a 1 second, implies that all the winds are prograde. So if you look at the winds now, you can see they're all blowing in the positive direction. This is wind velocity in meters per second versus latitude. This is the equator. That's similar to what kind of structure you see at Jupiter, but at Jupiter, some of the winds are blowing backwards so that the zero would be over here. Of course, if we have the period wrong, that statement might not be true. But that statement did seem odd, and people did worry about that radio period. For example, at Earth, we have trade winds. They blow in both directions. They blow both west and east, and at Jupiter, too. So that was already a bit of a concern, but there were more surprises in store. Ulysses, coming a few years, the Voyager measurements were made in 1980-81. Ulysses, a decade, more than a decade later, found that instead of 10.66 plus or minus 0.002, they were getting 10.77 hours in March 95, and a year later when they came close again, they found the 10.69 hours. I think there was a tendency for people on this side of the Atlantic to ignore this data because this was done by some French scientists. But when Cassini arrived at Saturn, it found a period that was almost the same as the period that Ulysses had reported in 1995, 10.76 hours, and both of those numbers are outside of the uncertainty. So Here you can see the periodograms showing spectral power at different periods, and this is the Voyager data, and this is the Cassini data, and you can see that there are very, very sharp peaks, and the separation is very significant. Well, no plausible torques could have changed the rotation of a planet as large as Saturn so rapidly, so this was a real puzzle. But not only did we find that there had been a change over a decade, but during the time that Cassini was in orbit around Saturn, and here these are data from early January of 04 through middle of 06, what they found was that the period was drifting. And let me tell you how this data shows that. What they're showing you is they've assumed that the planet is drifting at a steady period. If it's drifting at a steady period, we'll call it P, then you can define a longitude as 2 pi times the change t minus some initial time divided by the period. And that will give you a longitude, mod 2 pi, of course, and that lambda shouldn't vary. So they plotted versus longitude so defined. They plotted the power that they were seeing in the radio emissions. And you, instead of staying at a fixed position, it was drifting. That suggested that the period was changing by of order of 1% over 1 year. Doing a fit to that drift in the assumed longitude, they were able to come out with a period which itself changes with time by 1%. Using the time-dependent period, they find that the peak power, this is showing you 2 cycles of longitude so that you can see the full power peak. It stayed at a rather fixed longitude over the time used to fit the data. We now have another year of data, and it doesn't work at all beyond the fit doesn't work. There's already a published new fit. It gives you the opportunity of writing a paper every year. But the important thing, I mean, I'm not making fun of this. It's important. The period is not a fixed period. It cannot be the internal period of Saturn. Something's changing with time, but we don't know what it is. And we don't know what's making this oscillation. Well, it turns out, though, that if you take the period as defined by the radio period, the time-varying radio period, you find that it orders other data as well. And now I have to remind you, the part that I'm really interested in is the magnetosphere of Saturn. Saturn's magnetic field carves a cavity in the solar wind plasma, which is blowing out from the sun at roughly 400 kilometers per second. It confines the plasma of Saturn within a boundary we call the magnetopause. Within that boundary, there is a lot of ionized material at a very large range of energies. One of the principal sources of the ionized material, the plasma in the magnetosphere, is the small moon Enceladus, which itself is a fascinating story. Turns out that when you look at particle and field measurements within this magnetosphere, you find periodicities, many of which were unanticipated, and which relate very closely to this nominal, quote, planetary rotation period. So it's not I will use the word planetary rotation period, but it is not the rotation of the planet. It's the rotation of something that rotates approximately with the planet. Well, what other kinds of things do we find are organized by this period? Well, here I show you data from the magnetometer. So this magnetic field recorded by Cassini's magnetometer, And I'm showing you the three components of the magnetic field and the field magnitude. So in black, I have the radial component. At large distance, the radial component dominates. I'm showing you in green the azimuthal component, and in red the north-south component, and blue is the total field. At large distances, beyond about 15 Saturn radii, the radial component dominates, and what you can see is that there is an oscillation where the radial component decreases in magnitude, and its sign, of course, is negative, and at the same time, the azimuthal component decreases in magnitude. They do this in phase. In the center, you can see that the radial component reaches a peak half a cycle before the azimuthal component reaches a peak. Now, let me show you what that means. It means that close in, the field is rotating. Think about it. Let me go back a minute. I'm going to show you that if I'm making a measurement here, I see the field looking radially toward me. It's radially toward me, followed by positive azimuthal. Outside 15 RS, it just it gets bigger, and then it gets smaller. So it oscillates outside, and it rotates inside. And here I have a blow up of showing you more clearly the way this works. So, and the vertical lines are one Saturn, quote, rotation period. So you see that everything is nicely periodic in the field measured as the spacecraft is in orbit around Saturn. It's periodic. In fact, we have to correct here for spacecraft motion, because it turns out that the magnetic signature is really tied to something that is rotating with this time-varying rotation period, and there's a Doppler shift correction that has to be made. But again, what I want to show you is that inside the peak of the azimuthal component is not lined up with the peak of the radial component, but in the beyond 15 Jovian radii, they are in antiphase. One goes up when the other goes down. So something is happening at a distance of, I say 15, it's somewhere between 11 and 15 Saturn radii. There's a change in the character of the magnetic field. By following the periodicity in the in-situ magnetic field measured by the spacecraft, you can confirm the slow drift of the period. It's one of these is the result published from the radio frequency, and one is the result obtained from the magnetometer, and they track each other and are within the uncertainty of either measurement. But none of this tells us what imposes the periodicity on the magnetic signature. Now, let's first talk about how you might make a magnetic signature of the sort that you see with the azimuthal and radial component in antiphase. We see that at Jupiter, where there is a tilted dipole moment, so it's rotating around this axis. Here's a spacecraft. At this point, the spacecraft is above the magnetic equator, as I show you here. Now, half a cycle later, the dipole field is tilted the other way. Now the spacecraft is below the magnetic equator, and so you see the spacecraft going up and down relative to the magnetic equator. And that accounts for, in quite good detail, the oscillations that you see in this plot of the components and magnitude of the field. It also accounts for time-varying particle fluxes, because the particle fluxes maximize near the magnetic equator. So at Jupiter, we're accustomed to seeing this kind of periodicity, and we relate it to a tilted dipole. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm going the wrong way. Hitting the wrong button. So, again, at Saturn, you might think that that explanation is useless, but I'm going to show you there is a way of getting it. Far from Saturn, the magnetic variations do behave as if you have a magnetic equator flapping up and down, and that you would get that with a dipole tilt. But that's only at large distance. Inside 15 RS, you need still some other process. Okay, how do people try to explain it? There's one model published by Goldreich and Farmer. They propose that there is a region of higher plasma density that is unstable to outward displacement through what we call interchange. They would bring this dense plasma region radially outward. They then show you a set of currents that would be set up by this process. So they have current flowing radially outward along this tongue of plasma, and also flowing azimuthally across this tongue of plasma. There are some aspects of this description that are incorporated in later in other interpretations. But what I want to focus on is the currents that are implied by this model, a radially outward current. A radially outward current implies signatures that are not found in the data. If a radially outward current, use your right-hand rule, it says that if you're below the current, you will have an azimuthal component of the magnetic field in the sense of planetary rotation, and above you will have an azimuthal component opposite to planetary rotation. We have looked at every pass through the equator, and here's one, you can't read it, but it starts at minus 23 degrees, it goes through the equator and up to 17 degrees, and the oscillation doesn't skip a beat. We have many examples. You go right through the equator, and I mean, this current might be flowing a little bit off the equator, but we explore tens of degrees around the equator, and we do not see it skip a beat. So it's very hard to... One can also look at similar requirements on the radial component. We do not see these changes in the perturbation magnetic field. There's another model proposed by Gurnett and colleagues, who similarly have a region of high density, which they observe in their... they can infer the density from lines in their radio spectrum, and they find that there is as they come close to the planet, there is a very strong azimuthal variation in the density, and they then also propose an outflow. My problem with that is very much the same. Again, I focus on regions near the equator, and what an outflow would do to a magnetic field that is going north-south is it would introduce a kink. That kink means that I would have a radially outward component when I was above the equator. At the same time, I have a radially inward component when I'm below the equator. So if I go through the equator, I should see a change of phase, which I do not observe in the magnetometer data. So there are two of the models, both assuming something about transport of plasma radially outward. Karana and colleagues have come up with yet another proposal. They suggest that there's an asymmetric ring current. So that means it's a current system that varies that encircles the planet at a distance of something like 8 or 10 Saturn radii and is very asymmetric. Here's an image that we have from what they call the neutral analyzer, neutral mass analyzer. I've forgotten what they call it. But they look at neutral particles scattered off of charged particles in the magnetosphere. And so they can actually image the distribution of energetic particles around the planet. And they do find strong asymmetries. And those asymmetries propagate at roughly the planetary rotation period. So the Khurana et al. Model says the energetic particles are asymmetric. They produce an asymmetry in the bulk plasma by making certain regions more accessible to ionization. The result is that there is a very strong asymmetry of charged particle mass as a function of azimuth. And with that model, they argue that the magneto tail can go up and down, up when there's in the sector where there's less plasma and down in the sector where there is more plasma. This is an appealing and interesting proposal, but I have a problem that they insist that the region of intense energetic particle flux is refreshed once each rotation by a magnetic reconnection in the magnetotail. That's an instability of the magnetotail that injects energetic plasma into the inner part of the magnetosphere. Why don't I like this model? Well, incidentally, Khurana is one of my closest colleagues, and we argue incessantly. So he knows all about my objections. So reconnection is called for to keep the clock running, and the best place to study reconnection is in Earth's magnetotail, and we have been studying it for years. It is hard to set clocks by a process that appears as stochastic as magnetic reconnection. We still don't know at Earth what makes reconnection take off. And to assume that it takes off regularly enough to maintain a period, even at the 1% level, I find very hard to believe. The other thing is that the energetic particles are required to create these zones of increased ion density. And energetic particles trapped in a dipolar field rotate at rates that vary with radial distance. Their azimuthal drift is not constant. So I don't see how particles drifting at different rotation rates at different distances can be used to set a clock. So I don't accept this model, but it is an interesting one. So now the last one I'm going to tell you about is the model of Southwood and Kivelson, and you can imagine I like that one a lot better. It relies heavily on the observations that I was describing about the radial and azimuthal components of the magnetic field. It doesn't provide a mechanism, but it provides our model doesn't provide a mechanism, but it provides an interpretation of the observations. And so what we remind you is that close in, the field goes round and round, and that means that there's an entire region within a roughly circular boundary with Saturn at the center that has a uniform field going round and round near the equator, and far out it's getting bigger and smaller. Now, what we would argue is that beyond 15 Saturn radii. The perturbations look like those imposed by a slightly tilted dipole rotating with the planet. How could I get a slightly tilted dipole rotating with the planet only inside of 15 RS? I mean, only outside of 15 RS. Well, if I made an equatorial dipole, here's an equatorial dipole. I'm going to make an equatorial dipole, and now I add that to the axial dipole. It gives me a tilted dipole. Sum of two dipoles is a dipole. It's a tilted dipole. How do you make a dipole? If you have currents flowing on a sphere, you can create a system that has a dipole configuration outside and a uniform field inside. That's a well-known solution of the moment equations. Well, that sounds very nice, only currents in magnetized plasmas don't like to flow on spherical surfaces, but they do like to flow along the background field. Turns out that conductivity across the magnetic field in a magnetized plasma is quite low compared with conductivity along the magnetic field. So if you want to set up a current in a plasma, a good place to do it is along the background field. At 15 Saturn radii, the background field looks like the field of an aligned dipole. So suppose I take this sphere and I just try to make dimples north and south, then it'll look a lot like a dipole shell. This is what a magnetic dipole shell at 15 Saturn radii would look like. And now suppose I set up currents on that shell that are the analog of those currents flowing on the sphere. So you notice that the currents flowing on the sphere go all the way around. I'm going to have to put the currents on this thing going from the southern hemisphere, ionosphere, around into the northern hemisphere and back out. It's a very peculiar current pattern. I have a little red dot here to show you an equatorial point. At that equatorial point, the field comes out of the shell, and these are actual solutions of that current model. It looks very much like an equatorial dipole outside the shell. You can see the field lines concentrated near the x-axis, where with the current centered along the y, strongest along the y-axis. So you get an equatorial dipole outside of the shell of current, and inside you get something that isn't quite a uniform field, but it's awfully close to a uniform field. And so this is an equatorial cut. If you look at a meridional cut, you can see these dipole field lines coming out. If you put them together, you get a tilted dipole outside. The whole structure rotates at a rate close to planetary rotation. And so the question is, does this picture fit the data? So what we've done is to take passes through this configuration. When added to the background field, we find indeed, here I've just added that perturbation field to the background field, and what you can see is it really does look like the field of a tilted dipole with an equator that is slightly below the geographic equator here and above here, and as it rotates, that would change. The equator would go up and down. That can account for the apparent flapping at large distances. When we match our model to the data, we can do a very good job at the large distances. These are radial distances from 23 to 28 Saturn radii. We do have a we have to set one cycle of the period, and then we find that we get a really pretty good representation of the variations, although our amplitudes need to be increased. But again, I'm not going to take the detailed look that explains how we can change the amplitudes. It does a pretty good job on the evidence outside, excuse me, on the data outside of 15 Saturn radii. And here are some data from inside 15 Saturn radii. This goes from 7.5 to 12, and we can get a pretty good match of at least the radial and azimuthal components. The north-south component is not doing quite so well, and we think we understand that too. Okay, so now these currents then become of interest for the following reason. The radio frequency emissions that are being used to characterize periodicity are generated in regions where field-aligned currents flow out of the ionosphere. And from our model, by looking at the magnetometer data, we can work out when the current is flowing out of the southern hemisphere at any particular point in the planetary rotation. The evidence is that the radio frequency emissions occur. In this picture, it's shown coming out of the northern hemisphere, but in fact, it appears to be coming out of the southern ionosphere in the morning sector. The morning sector, the sun being up here somewhere, this is the morning sector. What we have done is to look for data where the spacecraft is at high southern latitudes, and in this data here, the latitude is plotted with the blue curve, planetary latitude, and I somehow missed putting the actual numbers on, but this is it starts at minus 32 degrees, goes down to minus 54, and up to plus 54. And just as we cross the L shells, where we believe the currents are strongest, the azimuthal component of the field switches sign. That's a sign that you've gone across an intense current, and you can figure out the direction of the current, and it's a current that is out of the southern ionosphere, making this very sharp change in the azimuthal component of the magnetic field. We can also tell that this is occurring at the point of our cycle that we would have predicted that the current is flowing out of the southern ionosphere. So there seems to be a connection between the periodic variations of the magnetic field driven by the currents flowing external to Saturn and the periodicity of the Saturn kilometric radiation. The big problem is, there is a great deal of support for the picture that there is a current system of the sort that I've shown you. There is absolutely no answer to the question of why there is such a current. We, of course, have tried to think about ways in which we could account for the current. All of the ways that we think about require a difference in ionospheric conductivity at the two ends of the magnetic flux tube. And the problem is that if you have a high conductivity ionosphere at one end and a low conductivity ionosphere at the other end, you can drive currents between the two ionospheres to try to make the two ionospheres flow at the same rate, rotate at the same rate. Why might you have different conductivities in one ionosphere, a high order magnetic anomaly might have escaped direct detection by the magnetic field instruments on the different spacecraft that have passed by Saturn. But the problem is we need a magnetic anomaly of order m equals 1. It has to vary like sine or cosine of the longitude. And it's very hard to believe that that would have escaped detection. You can get asymmetries in the two hemispheres if the underlying atmospheres have different properties. So far, we find no evidence that we can establish a difference between the atmospheres at the two ends of the flux tube. And if we did find differences, we're not quite sure how the shears that would imply would be maintained. But the appealing part about attributing the periodicity and the asymmetries to ionospheric asymmetries is that at least an ionosphere coupled to an underlying atmosphere could plausibly vary in its rotation period by 1% a year. So all I can say is stay tuned. We're still trying to find interpretations of what we think the data appear to show us. And anybody who has a suggestion for a solution would be make me very happy. So then the question is, what is the real internal period? And there is a set of arguments that's been put forward by Schubert and Anderson. They use arguments related to the shape of gravitational potential surfaces. It's not unambiguous that their analysis is fully worked out, but they come up with a period of 10 hours and 32 minutes, which is a lot shorter than any of the periods that have been inferred from electromagnetic phenomena. The nice thing about their number is that if you put their period in, it means that some of the winds flow east and some flow west, which would be good, and that seems appealing. But there is another evidence of a shorter period in the radio wave spectra. We've been concentrating on the higher frequency emissions that are the Saturn kilometric radiation, but there are also these emissions at lower frequencies. They're less common, they're not there all the time, and they're bursty. But they have a slightly different period from the period that was inferred from the Saturn kilometric radiation, and it's very close to the period inferred by Schubert and Anderson. But as you can see from these data, September, August, May, they're not there all the time, and it makes it very hard to understand why we're getting these bursts at all. When we get them, what is imposing the periodicity on them? But it is interesting that the period turned out to be pretty close to the period inferred by Schubert and Anderson. So the bottom line is that the Schubert and Anderson analysis still needs more testing. Confirmation from electromagnetic evidence is also great, but we need to follow those higher frequency bursts for a longer time to find out if that period lasts. What we do know is that there is a time-varying period that shows up in many electromagnetic and magnetic properties. It must be linked to something other than the planetary interior rotation period. And so I summarize by saying that Cassini has provided a wonderfully obscure set of riddles, and we're discovering aspects of planetary science that no one predicted, and it's great fun to be studying planetary magnetospheres at this time. Thank you. They precess at roughly the planetary rotation. Could be, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. You mean if the planet itself is rotating more rapidly? Oh, okay. If right. Right, okay. Well, I think that all of them are arguing that the differential is produced by something that is not directly connected to the planet, but is connected, has to be to its ionosphere. I mean, all of these external plasmas are, even at Jupiter, you understand, the planetary rotation is not fully imposed beyond a few Jupiter radii. I mean, when you look at the plasma at Jupiter, you find that you get... I mean, I go back to Jupiter because we understand it much better, and there are many similar features. And at Jupiter, we can find that the plasma co-rotates with the planet out to about 20 Saturn radii, Jupiter radii. After 20, it begins to depart very significantly, reaches about half of this Jupiter rotation period by the time you get out to, maybe 30, and then remains roughly half. Now, the question then is, why is that? And the reason is it's complicated. The thing that maintains the plasma rotating with the planet is that every time it tries to slow down, currents couple it to the ionosphere of the planet, and they exert a torque to keep it. If your ionospheric conductivity is not high enough, it will slow the coupling will actually slow the ionosphere. I mean, there's no requirement that the ionosphere win. So as you get to higher latitudes, the ionospheric conductivity goes down, and it gets easier to slow down the ionosphere and not speed up the plasma. So I don't think that there's an underlying magic in this number. I think I think if we could come up with a number that relates it to the ionospheric conductivity, and that would give you this kind of number. Well, let me first say that there's a symmetry of Saturn that people have found totally incomprehensible, because it violates a fundamental theorem, Cowling's theorem, that says you can't make a totally symmetric dipole, right? So this is the person you should be asking. So a year from now, you can ask Sabina to give you a talk on how Saturn gets to be so irritating. I've heard... You know, I'm an outsider when it comes to planetary dynamos. So I have heard answers from, well, Cowling said it couldn't be strictly aligned, but less than a degree is okay. However, the data do not make it clear that all we can say is that the dipole moment is aligned to within better than a degree. But it might be half a degree off. So that's one way out. Sabina's pursuing an argument that suggests that it can be the asymmetric components of the dynamo can be shielded by an external layer within Saturn, conducting layer, but I wouldn't dare talk about it in front of them. Solar wind. Could this be a solar wind effect? Could it be the effect of a changing solar wind? And there actually is a group in France who pursued the question of whether variations in solar wind properties could account for the drifting period. And their most recent paper shows a fairly good correlation between the speed of the solar wind, the radial outflow speed, and the period of the kilometric radiation. But I think that, you know, my own view is that you can account for small changes with that kind of effect, but I would find it very hard to imagine that this rather systematic year and a half of slow drifting could be explained in that way.
I'm interested in the kilohertz to megahertz of radiation. First, how it's actually observed by the satellite. Uh-huh.
They do have both electric field antenna and a search coil antenna. The electric field antenna is an enormous wire.
And just what sort of mechanisms are thought to generate that radiation?
Yeah. I can tell you better what they think at Jupiter, because I've studied that more carefully. But in all cases, these emissions are thought to be generated by interaction with accelerated electrons. So in order to carry the currents that are needed between the equator and the ionosphere, it turns out that field-aligned potential drops develop, and they accelerate the electrons very, very strongly. Those accelerated electrons then make various plasma instabilities, and the plasma instability that they focus on is one that emits the energy in a cone, and so you see the radiation from Jupiter only when the cone intersects the field of view. And so at Jupiter, where the dipole is rotating, you intersect the field of view once or twice per orbit, per rotation period. There are some very good papers, you know, explaining this. I can refer you to them. But it's accelerated electrons that provide the energy for the...
In the interest of time, we're going to stop with questions there, but if you have questions, you can come up afterwards. But please join me in thanking the speaker.
Okay.